You know, we're a fan of history around here. We can learn an awful lot from it. We can look back and see what's done right, what's done wrong, the impact over time as well. What about our Declaration of Independence, right? America's 250th, our celebration's at hand. Going to go back a few hundred years today and explore some of those origins. And guess what? Author and educator Rob Nadelson just finished a 6-part series on the Declaration of Independence. You may have read that. It was carried in the Epic Times. And that was looking at the men who wrote and defended it, the value and meaning of it. We are going to get all over that here today. America found its footing 250 years ago and then had to fight and win its freedoms as well. The professor, original show host Rob Nadelson, returns for a vital history lesson today on Voices of Mon. We go back in history today to talk about our Constitution as well, but we'll go back in history on this show as well. Welcome our original show host again, Rob Nadelson, a constitutional scholar. Historical legal research has been cited by the Supreme Court. I think, and good morning, Rob. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, Tom. How are you? Always wonderful to be talking to a Montana audience.
Yeah, great to have you here, too, on. And there's so many things to kind of catch up on here as well. And I like this series. I was going to do as part of an introduction here. You know, you're cited often by the U.S. Supreme Court, but you had like a run, I think, in 2013, 14, 15, or 16, where a number of your citations were used by the Supreme Court. So congratulations on that. That obviously is, why don't you tell us what that means to you as an educator?
Well, actually, it started, you know, when I was at the University of Montana faculty, for one reason or another, my work didn't attract much notice. But when I moved to the Independence Institute, they started to push out my constitutional research, and it came to the attention of Supreme Court justices. So beginning in 2013, I started to get cited by Supreme Court justices. I was cited by Clarence Thomas, by Antonin Scalia, by Chief Justice Roberts, by Samuel Alito. And it kind of snowballed. My big year was in 2023, where I picked up something like 11 citations. And I've had two more this year as well. So we're up to 31 now, which I'm told puts me in the top 10 or so of scholars nationwide.
Wow, holy cow, and congratulations on that. And it happened over time, and we've been the benefit of it here in Montana an awful lot. I mean, you started this show many years ago. You ran as a conservative. You ran for governor. You led some initiatives in the state of Montana, and all the while, you know, really keeping us close to those constitutional roots. I think we can say that we've gotten away from them, right? When I read your 6-part series, and it's excellent, by the way, you can get it on Epic Times, but it's at the Independence Institute. And then you also have it, Mountain States Policy Center, right?
Mountain States Policy Center originally provoked the idea, and they've now published, I think, 3 of the 6. You can see all 6 on my personal website, which is NadelsonRob.com, my name backwards, NatelsonRob.com. So all 6 are there, but it's also being picked up by the Missoulian, by the Billings Gazette, by the Montana Standard, and by at least one newspaper in Idaho.
Yeah, and I'm seeing that around. So congratulations on that as well. And it's people are thirsty for it, I think. Do you see that? I'm wondering, I know we'll get into it here, but I'm looking at, we're trying to gin up some energy and emotion for this 250th celebration. There's a lot of turmoil in our country, and I'm not sure if people are feeling patriotic about it.
Tom, there's always a lot of turmoil. That's one reason I think I enjoy working in constitutional law. There's never any shortage of issues going on. But I think you're right in that we are living in a difficult time right now, which is matched only by 2 other occasions in American history. And that is a time when a significant minority of the American people, and I emphasize it's a minority, but it's significant, seem to reject the basic foundational principles of our country.
Yeah.
It happened during the Revolution itself. There were a group of people, Americans, who were called Tories, and they thought it was absolutely fine that the king and parliament could do whatever they want with the American colonies, for the most part. And then, of course, it happened during the Civil War when the South rejected the idea that all men are created equal, part of our founding creed. And now you see it with there are few people on the far right, but mostly people on the far left, a lot more of them, reject the very notion of, it seems, of inalienable rights or rights coming from God or government being limited to protecting those rights. So it is a difficult time, and it's a great time to reconnect with our founding and to understand again what it was about, why it happened, and the sacrifices the men and women made to make it happen.
Let's start with inalienable rights. What are they? What's the concept behind that?
Okay. The term alienable, not inalienable yet, but just the term alienable is a legal term. You know, most of the leading founders had legal training. Not all, but most of them did. And so it's a legal term. To alienate something has nothing to do with with people, with foreigners or anything like that. To alienate something means to transfer it to somebody else, to sell it or to give it away. So, for example, I've got a dollar bill. It's alienable. I take it into the cleaners and helps pay for my cleaning. Something that's unalienable, it's something that sticks to me that can never be transferred away. Now, the idea that of government that dominated the founding generation was the idea that in the beginning, people had no government, but what they did is they realized that anarchy was not a very good system. You know, you could not live and prosper under anarchy. So what they did is they selected a government. It might be a king, it might be a council, whatever. And they transferred to that government certain rights, or as we would say in modern America, certain powers. See, the term rights and powers often meant the same thing in the 18th century. They transferred to the government certain powers, like the power to use force, in order to protect what they saved. Now, what Jefferson is saying in the Declaration of Independence is, yeah, we can give away a lot of powers to government. We can give government the power to tax, for example. But there are certain rights we can never give away. They are inalienable. And they include such things as life, liberty, and property, to be more specific, free speech, freedom of the press, right of self-defense, the right to private property, and so forth. They can never be given away. And it's the function of government to protect those rights. And when government stops protecting those rights, it is the prerogative, the right of the people to overthrow or change that government and establish a government that does protect the rights. That's a basic central concept of the beginning of the Declaration of Independence.
And that's what fascinates me here, too, is, you know, there's an understanding of natural law, I think. This was part of your fifth series here. It was ideas linked to John Locke. So kind of well established, but people understood, we should be equal, have God-given rights. But the Declaration, did it go farther when it talked about people have a right to replace governments that violate those laws?
Well, you're right about natural law. Natural law is the notion that there is an order of things in nature. And part of that order of things is that people have certain rights that they can give away and certain rights that they can't give away. Under the version that was dominant in the founding era, God gave people those rights. The rights didn't come from government, they came from God. It is possible to be an atheist and also believe in inalienable rights. Mm. A great example was Ayn Rand, the great objectivist writer, novelist, and philosopher. But for the most part, people who believe in natural law believe that natural law is created by God and divine command. And so when you create a system where the government starts interfering with the rights that it's supposed to protect, well, then it is your duty, really, to act to overthrow it or to change it. Now, let me just caution here. Jefferson also makes the point that as a matter of prudence, it doesn't mean you want to overthrow the government every time it does something you don't like, even if it does things that you don't like for a long period of time. But eventually, things get so bad and they become incurable any other way. And so you can replace one government by another. It doesn't have to be violently. It could be peaceably, as in the revolution of 1689 in Britain, from which our own founders took such inspiration.
Oh, yeah. The now the concept of 13 separate sovereign states. Again, I'm kind of focusing here on this fifth essay in your six-part series here. You note the Declaration did not create law, and then it recognized 13 separate states. I'm wondering, do you think our founders would recognize this country today, or some of the decisions that this country makes, having, I think, set us up to be, you know, as much as we could, really separate sovereign authorities?
Yeah, you know, that's one area where there is a difference between popular perception and what the Declaration actually did. Mm. I mean, we celebrate the 4th of July as the beginning of our country, our nation. But actually, if you read the Declaration of Independence, the word United States is used, but United is with a small u, states is with capital S. Mm. And the final part of the Declaration, which is what we lawyers call the operative form, the form that actually has the legal effect, talks in terms of independent states. And that's really what the Declaration did. It proclaimed the creation of independent states. Now, the independent states got together right away, and they decided to create a diplomatic assembly known as the Continental Congress. And that Continental Congress was given the power by the states. But it is important to understand that states really did come first. Now, some people will say that the states created the United States. That's not really true. The people created the United States. But the states did come first. Now, your question is, would people recognize the country today, people from the founding era? And I'm not fully sure they would, mm-hmm. because while we still have a lot of state powers and state prerogatives, we have centralized things a whole lot more than the folks who drafted the Declaration of Independence or who approved the Constitution would have wanted. And one of the reasons we have a kind of a crisis right now, we have these divisions in the country, is precisely because the government has become too centralized, which means that every political issue is a federal issue, and there are always winners and losers, rather than creating a situation where Californians can make decisions for themselves, Montanans can make decisions for themselves, and so forth.
Rob Nadelson with us here today, one of America's leading constitutional scholars, actually also taught law, most of that at the University of Montana, 25 years, constitutional law, history, and a prolific writer as well. He's got a new series out. It's been actually penned for about maybe a month now. I forget when the first one goes back, but it's a six-part series on the Declaration of Independence. Rob Nadelson is with us here today, and welcome back to you. Thank you again for joining us. Rob, Nancy's on the line here. We're going to get into that in just a little bit. There's some characters, right, in our founding fathers, and Nancy, I'll have you just come on right now and talk about, because I think Thomas Jefferson is one of them. I think you can go back and maybe name all of the people that we know well as characters, John Adams and Ben Franklin. And there's a guy that we'll talk about here, Rob, that you wrote about, John Dickinson, who warned against independence. But Nancy is joining us from Roundup now, listening on the Mighty 790 KGHL. Good morning, Nancy. You're on with the professor.
Well, good morning, Tom. Thank you so much for having me on the air here and accepting my phone call. And thank you for having Rob on. He is a fabulous person. And Rob, I have the privilege of talking with you on American history. And I just talked to you a few days ago, and I'm so glad to get the opportunity again. And I want to talk, I'll focus on T.J. Thomas Jefferson a little bit, and then I have a question for you. T.J. was born in 1743, and of course he died July the 4th, 1826, 50 years after the Declaration of Independence was drafted and signed. And of course he was our first Secretary of State. He made foreign policy, and the Louisiana Purchase, he contributed that doubled the size of our nation. And I just can't say enough about our founding fathers, and especially about T.J., and you were talking about inalienable rights. In my opinion, that is a decent respect for humanity. And, you know, the Declaration of Independence is actually a vision of liberty. And nobody understood that more than our founding fathers, especially T.J. And now my question for you, Rob, is this. Thomas Jefferson was a young 33-year-old man who drafted the Declaration of Independence in 17 days. And he presented it to our young Congress. We were only a nation of 13 states. He presented it to our young Congress at that time, and they shredded one quarter of it. What didn't the Congress at that time like about Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence? And I also want to know how many people were in Congress at that time. Was it still, since we were such a young country, were there still two congressmen in each state at that time? And thank you so much, Rob, and God bless. And once again, have a wonderful, wonderful 4th of July celebration.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you, Nancy. It is always an honor to talk to you. Let me address this in reverse order. I don't recall how many people were in Congress at the time. There were 56 signers to the Declaration of Independence. That gives you an approximate idea, but there were some dissenters. John Dickinson, who Tom just mentioned, was one of the dissenters. So he was in Congress at the time, but he didn't sign, and he had good, strong reasons for not doing so, I might add. He was a patriot. It was nothing cowardly about him. Regarding Jefferson's initial draft of the Declaration of Independence, there were some things in there that were just kind of, they didn't fit. I mean, the style was odd. I mean, there were phrases like distinguished die being D-Y-E, I think, that would just sounded odd. But the biggest problem that the Congress saw in the initial draft was that Jefferson tried to blame the British for the slave trade. While Jefferson was a slaveholder, he, like most Virginians, ultimately opposed, most Americans, ultimately opposed slavery, thought it violated natural law, thought it needed to be eventually extinguished, but that the slave trade needed to be eliminated right away because it was inhuman. That was a view that prevailed in Virginia. Anyway, in his initial draft of the Declaration, he basically took the posture that the British were forcing the slave trade on us. And that really wasn't true. I mean, several states wanted to continue the slave trade, notably South Carolina and Georgia. They wanted to continue at least for a while. And in addition, the founders recognized at this point that unity was all important. This was a decision they had to make at the Constitutional Convention, too. They had to give up their opposition to slavery. Not everybody opposed slavery, but most did. They had to give up the opposition to slavery in order to maintain unity because they did not want the country to go the way of Europe and turn into 13 squabbling sovereignties that fought against each other, a situation in which the slaves themselves would have suffered the most. So they had to take that stuff that Jefferson wrote opposing the slave trade out of the Declaration, and that was the largest part that they removed.
And talk about that Committee of Five, because, you know, I don't know who Roger Sherman is or Robert Livingston, but I know of John Adams and I know of Benjamin Franklin. And that is the committee that was assigned with Thomas Jefferson to come up with a draft for the Declaration of Independence.
That's right.
Was that an odd mix? Was that purposely an odd mix? Or did they put together certain elements to try and come up with something a little more encompassing?
Good question. The Continental Congress had been giving most of its writing assignments to John Dickinson, who was a fine writer. But Dickinson was arguing against independence at that point. He thought it was premature. He had good reasons. He may have been mistaken, but he had good reasons. He and this is described in my series, he and John Adams debated it on January 1, 1776, one of the most momentous debates in American history. Adams won his point. And so, given Dickinson's views, they knew they couldn't give Dickinson the job of drafting the Declaration. Jefferson, while young, as Nancy points out, was known to be a fine writer, so he got onto the committee. Ben Franklin got on the committee because of his standing. John Adams is the foremost advocate of independents got on the committee. Roger Sherman of Connecticut, who was known, who was a, I described him as a dynamo of a man who just accomplished an enormous amount. He was a conciliator, but he was also a doer. So he got on the committee. And Robert R. Livingston got on the committee. Livingston was an outstanding lawyer. He served as the number one judge in New York State for 24 years. He later, by the way, teamed up with James Monroe in negotiating the Louisiana Purchase. So Livingston has a lot of credit for doubling the size of the country. Yeah. That was under President Jefferson. And then Livingston actually went on to help with Robert Fulton create the first steamboat to ply the Hudson River. So all of these men were extraordinarily talented. And I think they were selected partly for that reason and partly because they represented a mix of states. So you had Adams from Massachusetts and Sherman from Connecticut and Livingston from New York and Franklin from Pennsylvania and Jefferson from Virginia.
Talk about John Dickinson. I've got like about 2 minutes here, and I was surprised maybe to find out that, and why not? I mean, there you call it a great debate. Now we just don't even think there was a debate, right? Now we're debating about how we keep our freedoms, not invent our freedoms. But yeah, go ahead.
John Dickinson was not another one of these distinguished lawyers. He had been educated in England as a lawyer, and he, although he was born here about the same time as George Washington was born, and he had led the charge all through the colonial era. When we were pushing against Britain and demanding no taxation without representation, and we need to be self-governing and so forth, it was Dickinson who more than any other person took the lead. He became, along with Benjamin Franklin, one of the first two American worldwide celebrities. But when the vote came on independence, he thought it was premature for a number of reasons that I discuss in the second article in my series. He lost the debate. He withdrew from Congress so that the vote in favor of independence could be unanimous. And then Dickinson went and joined the Continental Army to fight for his country. So even though he opposed the decision, he agreed. He joined the army. Later on, he served an outstanding role in the drafting of the U.S. Constitution, and he was probably the only man I can think of in history who served simultaneously as the chief executive of two states at the same time, Delaware and Pennsylvania.
Talking about some of your writings here, I noted one. This goes back a few years, but the constitutional contributions of John Dickinson. So
That was written back in 2003. It's a scholarly article, the constitutional contributions of John Dickinson, and shows how his influence worked. For example, so those are the three positions the Supreme Court has to choose among them. Is birthright citizenship virtually automatic if your parents just happen to be here, or is birthright citizenship only if your parents are citizens or permanent residents, or, as I believe to be the case, are you a birthright citizen if your parents are here legally, or if you're a citizen?
I should move on, but I'm going to ask.
Not if your parents are here illegally. We'll see what the court does.
Can this court decide that in the current political environment? I mean, it's pretty hot.
They're going to have to, unless they can find some excuse to dismiss the case, like, oh, gee, on second analysis, we don't think the parties have standing. I don't think they're going to do that. I think they're going to have to decide that. And I think you might very well have a fractured court.
Oh, well, that doesn't surprise me. There have been justices who have shown a propensity to that, I think.
That's right. And by the way, it's not even, and not usually even, 6-3. That's a myth that the media have propounded. Mm-hmm. It's often 8-1, 7-2, 3-6 the other way, or unanimous, 5-4. Who knows?
Hit me up with about 60 seconds left and a little more than that on presidential powers.
Okay. During the New Deal era, especially during the progressive era, Congress passed laws that delegated powers to various executive agencies and then limited the ability of the president to remove the members of these agencies. President Trump is challenging that. He points out that the Constitution gives him the executive power. The Constitution says that. And so that should give him the right to remove people in the Federal Trade Commission, on the Federal Reserve Board, and in other executive agencies. The two cases before the court right now involve exactly those agencies. Can he remove members of the Federal Trade Commission? And can he remove members of the Federal Reserve System? My own view is that he should be able to remove members of the Federal Trade Commission, but I think removing members of the Federal Reserve Board is a tougher issue for historical reasons. I have no idea what the court is going to do with this.
Oh, well, that's interesting then. So there might be some surprises for you. We'd love to have you back, Rob. I know you have still maintained great connections here in Montana, and that's so much appreciated. So many years spent here, as well as being an advocate for us here in Montana.
Yep, I'll be spending two weeks there starting this weekend. I'm looking forward to it.
Glad to hear it. Get up high. Well, I know you're from Colorado, so there's lots of opportunities for that too, but I know you like to get out and hike. So, Rob, thank you so much. Senior fellow in constitutional jurisprudence at Mountain States Policy Center and the Independence Institute. Look them up. It's Rob Nadelson. For more information. Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.